Hello, everyone, and welcome to this event titled Identity Battles on Social Media. This event is put on by the LISI. It is LSE's research group on Southeastern Europe, and it is a part of the Hellenic Observatory Centre at the London School of Economics. I'm Denisa Kostovicheva, and I'm Professor of Global Politics at the European Institute, and I'm also the lead of the LISI group. Today, we turn attention to the question of how the users from the Western Balkans engage with social media and to what effects. Social media is the new global battleground of identity politics. It is a space where old conflicts are played out, reconfigured, or intensified, and where new contentions emerge. While the use of the social media by people in the region and from the region tracks these trends, arguably, closer scrutiny of these processes in the case of the Western Balkans can offer new insights because of the specific condition of the Western Balkans. The Western Balkans still lives under the shadow of the wars of the 1990s, and the fight for democracy, or to be more precise, to more substantive, better quality democracy, and for the rule of law is still ongoing. I'm absolutely delighted to welcome today's panelists who will draw on their research to answer questions about what happens when the legacies of violence are confronted online, what power do online content creators and debaters wield, and how does the technical architecture and design platforms of different social media shape their engagement? Of course, we're interested in all these questions in order to be able to evaluate broader effects of these processes and conversations. What I'll do now, I'll introduce our speakers in the order of speaking, and the first to speak will be Dr. Sanja Vico. Sanja Vico is a lecturer in communications and digital media at the Department of Communications, Drama and Film at the University of Exeter. She previously worked with us here at the LSE. She was a postdoctoral research fellow with program Justice Interactions and Peacebuilding, which was funded, has just completed by the European Research Council that I directed here at the European Institute. And yeah, Sanja was also with us as a fellow at the LISI, LSE unit on research on Southeast Europe. Sanja has recently just published a book with Routledge, Doing Nation in a Digital Age, Banal Expressions of Nationalism and Cosmopolitanism in Polymedia Environments. Sanja has widely published on issues of digital media in the context of migration, identity nationalism, and post-conflict justice and reconciliation. She has a PhD in media and communications from Goldsmiths at the University of London, an MSc from LSE, and a BA from the Faculty of Political Sciences at the University of Belgrade. So Sanja will go first to speak, but I will introduce all our speakers so we just proceed directly to the presentations. Our next speaker is Dr. Ivana Stepanović. Ivana Stepanović is a permanent research fellow and an academic coordinator and UNESCO chair for cultural heritage management and sustainability at the Institute of Advanced Studies, Kozak, Hungary. Ivana holds a PhD in anthropology from the Faculty of Philosophy at the University of Belgrade, an MA in Human Rights, Southeast Europe from University of Sarajevo, and University of Bologna, that was a joint program, and a BA in philosophy from Faculty of Philosophy, University of Belgrade. Previously, Ivana was a permanent research fellow at the Institute of Criminological and Sociological Research in Belgrade, Serbia. She was also a lecturer at the University of Pannonia, Kozak campus in Hungary. Ivana's research activities focus on digital ethnography of artificial intelligence, on social media, online activism, and the impact of artificial intelligence on societies. Ivana also has a recent book titled Influencers, Online Alliances and Reconciliation in Southeast Europe, hashtag Balkans. The book was published by Routledge in 2025, so both books hot off the press. And our third speaker will be Natasha Dimitrovska, assistant lecturer at the School of Media, Film and Journalism at Monash University. And thank you, Natasha, for bearing with us. It's midnight at your end in Australia. Natasha is teaching at the intersection of media communications and gender studies at Monash University. Her research interests focus on effective practices in online spaces, digital construction of identities, and gender-based violence. She has a particular interest in the enactment on everyday feminism in online spaces, examining how feminist activists navigate complex technological ecosystems to build awareness of and resist misogyny, violence against women, and oppressive experiences. Natasha has just completed her PhD, so watch this place for a book on these topics. So each speaker will speak for 15 minutes, and after which we're very much looking forward to Q&A sessions, and our panelists have agreed to answer questions. If you're tweeting, our hashtag on X is hashtag LSEEEEE. Okay, so Sonia, the floor is yours. You can start sharing your slides. Okay, and I'll just prompt you when it's 2 minutes.
Can you see?
Yes, it's perfect. Yeah.
Okay. So thank you very much, Denisa, for this invitation. And it's really great to be in this company of excellent scholars and on this relevant topic. So this presentation is largely based on my recently published book, Doing Nation in a Digital Age, but also my previously published journal articles, Globalized Difference, Identity Politics on Social Media, and Destigmatization Strategies of Serbian Londoners on Social Media. The book is available in most university libraries, including the LSE and the New York Public Library. I explored how Serbian Londoners navigate digital media environments to negotiate their identities with a focus on the banal expressions of nationalism and cosmopolitanism. For this, I conducted over 3-year-long ethnographic research, including both traditional and digital ethnography, and 40 in-depth interviews with Serbs in London, supplemented with autoethnographic observations and media maps. This research was carried out between July 2015 and November 2018. But now refer means that I studied practices that were happening daily or weekly, but that were also unremarkable and taken for granted. Serbs in London are a remarkably diverse group. The main point of distinction between them is the time when they arrived in the UK and London, which corresponds to their different motivations for migration. I have identified three waves of migration that were triggered by certain events in the former Yugoslavia and Serbia triggered these people to move. So first, it was the end of the Second World War and the real socialist regime in the Yugoslavia, and then there was the war of the 90s, and from roughly 2003, democratic transition and changes. As you can see, all these waves are diverse in itself, and perhaps the most diverse is the second wave, the most heterogeneous. What I was observing when I first started my research was ordinariness. There were many pictures and status updates of holidays, dining out, and so on. As you can see in these examples, there is a participation in Henley Regatta, which denotes a sense of Britishness, or a Sunday afternoon at a Soho-based members club, which also signals a social class. So it seemed at first that my participants were so blended in, and there wasn't anything really specific about them. But then I started talking with them, and then what they were telling me started contradicting these banal and ordinary practices observed in the fieldwork. Tanya is a second wave participant, and she was telling me this. It was really, this quote was particularly a turning point in my research. It was not only 1999, but before that time, when I moved in, coverage was horrendous about us. At one point, I started telling people that I'm Russian because I could not take questions any longer. Are you a war criminal? Are all Serbians killers? It was not only because news was so horrendous that I felt ashamed, but also because I was losing a country and identity. I could not relate my friends, family, people I knew to the headlines and stories written here. For me, at 22, it was very hard. I was having an identity crisis. But now they write about exit festival or good nightlife. It is really lovely that is now seen as a place that can be interesting and where people are normal. There has been an interesting shift. We were labeled in the early 1990s. It was like I would scream. And there were some other quotes similar to this from later participants, also those younger ones who weren't necessarily, who didn't move during the 90s. What this quote shows us is that identities are not purely a matter of choice. They are negotiated in relation to all the meanings that the others are attaching to us, and therefore identities depend also on how others perceive us. Identities are relational and performative, so they are negotiated and formed in relation to all these narratives and discourses. And there are layers of discourses, so it is not just the civil war of the 90s. Another layer is Southeastern Europeanness. This research took part around the time of the EU referendum in the UK, where anti-immigration discourses were very prominent, especially oriented towards Eastern Europeans, such as Poles, Romanians, Bulgarians. And because of their foreign sounding accents, they were sometimes mistaken for these other people. And the third layer would be the semi-periphery of the Balkans, which is this position in between the core, the Western countries, and developed Western countries and the peripheries. Global South, which means that these countries of the Balkans always are trying to catch up with the core, but also lagging behind, which creates this sense of chronic self insecurity. So, when do these platforms divide or unite, or under what conditions, which is one of the questions for this panel? So, what all these participants have in common is an orientation to the Serbian identity and the perception that their identity is stigmatized. But they differ in what they think the Serbian identity is about and how they respond to these perceptions. Most people would oscillate between national and cosmopolitan identities, but their expressions of national identities differ depending on the wave of migration and their coping strategy or responding strategies. So, as you'll see in some examples, show like taking pride in one's identity and educating others about their national culture to showing some kind of superiority or discrediting the West, which shows us that there are multiple banal nationalisms. And relatedly, what we are witnessing in the age of digital media is diversification of national identities. So what happens when legacies of war and dominant discourses are confronted online, and how social media shape this? What I observed were differences between how people perform their identities on publicly oriented platforms, those ones that are meant for like weak ties for diverse audiences that put people on a global stage vis-a-vis many different others, such as Facebook, Twitter, now X, or Instagram, and also privately oriented platforms, which are mainly used for communication with strong ties that is important to others, such as WhatsApp or Viber. While banal expressions of nationalism, cosmopolitanism on these publicly oriented platforms were often aimed at correcting national identity, at presenting it in a better or more favorable light, on privately oriented platforms, these identity performances were leading to reinforcing identities. And now, going to the different expressions of banal and nationalism, as you can see from this table, they are very much related to the coping strategy they're taking, or destigmatization strategy. Banal expressions of nationalism that were aimed at educating others and so on were associated with stigma recognition strategy, which refers to when people accept the stigma as justified, they identify with the values of the stigmatized or the normal. Whereas counter-stigmatization strategy also accepts the stigma, but they don't identify with the values of the stigmatizer, and in fact turn this stigma into an emblem of pride. They find pride in the stigma, so kind of shift the discourse around it. There is more to unpack in this video, in this slide, which I'm happy to do later in the Q&A, but you can see how this differs according to different waves of migration and associations with the first, second, or first, other, and third Serbia. So these are some examples of identity performances of publicly oriented platforms, as you can see. These banal expressions of nationalism that are associated with stigma recognition try to portray a Serbian identity in a favorable light by emphasizing some fa Serbian famous figures in sports or art or fashion. This particular image features an Instagram post that shows Time Out magazine that published about Serbian month in London, which happens around February. And then this caption is very revealing. It says this: "My colleague was excited to share the latest turn Time Out magazine with me this morning, as it features Serbia and Serbian places to eat and drink in London. It's the first article about Serbia in a while that doesn't talk about the war, but instead mentions our royal family, Novak Djokovic, Marina Abramovic, Roksandra Ilinčić, to name a few." So this shows you how this is meant to educate others about positive things about this identity. Whereas this example that is more associated with counter-stigmatization shows this image of a snowman and says, "It was snowing in London today. What a snowman." Kind of a very subtle tactic of ridiculing weather conditions in London, which has much deeper meanings than that. And then very common for banal expressions of cosmopolitanism are emphasis on international circles of friends, which shows this willingness to engage with the other, which is important characteristic of cosmopolitanism, but doing it in a very mundane, everyday manner, which is why it is banal. As you can see in this first image, there is tip left in different currencies, and again, a caption that is revealing this. It says, "This is how my crew leaves a tip," and then hashtag London International, expat life, and so on. And similarly, this image of participating in a Chinese karaoke night. Again, as you can see, there is a location here. Both examples also feature this emphasis on a social class. Just for the sake of time, I'll quickly skip this slide to go. I'm showing here identity performances on privately oriented platforms. Again, examples of banal nationalism. You can see there is a tennis ball there, which in itself can be very ordinary, right? But then when I started talking with this participant, I realized she was fascinated with Novak Djokovic. And then I also realized that this is not just because of his sporting achievements, but also because of his national identity. And then there is this communication with parents and family. Again, very mundane through these stickers, but this is what reinforces this sense of belonging to. In a national but also cosmopolitan terms. But I would particularly like to focus our attention at this quote, which shows how identities are negotiated through interpersonal communication, particularly with significant others on privately oriented platforms. Angela is a third way participant who was born in Serbia but then lived in many different countries before coming to London. She says this: "What is cool about these new forms of media is how quickly we can build and maintain these new identities. When I was 18, I had just a simple Motorola mobile phone. All I could do was to text and call. For me to stay in touch with my family, I had to call and email them, and emails were only from physical computers. The first few years while I was in New York, I felt I was a little bit out of touch with my Serbian roots because there was just no way for me to do anything about it. And I spoke Serbian so rarely, only when I picked up my phone and calls were so expensive. It's only when I got my BlackBerry that I had Facebook and email on my phone, which made it all easier, but you still didn't have Wi-Fi calling.
I
You
got 2 minutes,
still
sorry.
Yes,
Just two now.
I'm wrapping up. Thank you. Still didn't have immediate contact with people now, but now I can speak Serbian every day, so I think it makes it easier to maintain these little identities which you build up a long way because you're kind of always surrounded by the people who support that kind of identity. I identify with the traditions I was raised with and with the food. So yeah, I don't know how to answer where I come from because I don't think it is about where, I think it's about who. So, in lieu of conclusion, I developed this new theory and concept of national identity that is doing nation to capture and explain what was described in this last quote, but also all other examples. As a theory, doing nation possesses a nation comes into being and is sustained through everyday interpersonal communication practices that have become increasingly mediated, especially for migrants. But as we can see, these relationships of proximity and distance have become very similar in a digital age. As a concept, doing nation argues that the nation primarily represents these embodied discursive and cultural practices and not an abstract imagined community, as Benedict Anderson has famously argued. Therefore, I propose to think of the nation as a verb, doing nation to indicate this dynamic process instead of a noun. So it is these interpersonal communication practices, especially with significant others, that explain why people are susceptible or resilient or resistant to any media content that references or flags the nation, which is what Anderson talks about. It is important to say this communicative effectiveness of doing nation depends on the authority of the speaker, which is why these strong ties are important. So, who speaks? This is what secures the reception or the uptake and the shared understanding of the meanings or context. Just to remind you of what I said before, doing nation doesn't preclude cosmopolitan identities. As you can see, cosmopolitan identities were sometimes used as a tactic of kind of rehabilitating national identities, and therefore cosmopolitanism can paradoxically reproduce national identity. But also that doing nation neither reproduce one single diaspora nor a nation. I talked about the diversification of national identities. And finally, this concept and theory supplements existing relevant concepts such as banal nationalism or long distance nation, which I'm also drawing on by putting emphasis on interpersonal. And I finished there. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sonia. Now we move on to Ivana's presentation, and Ivana will be sharing her slides. If you're inspired by to ask any questions, you can start putting questions in, posing your questions.
Hello, thank you so much for having me. It is really a pleasure and honor to be here. I will share my screen now. Okay, if you see everything clearly, then I can start. So today I want to talk about this concept of algorithmic reconciliation and try to show you how social media redefine concepts of community and identity, both collective and individual identity, and how they open new avenues for transitional justice in the Balkans or the former Yugoslavia. Because Balkans is often viewed through the lens of nationalism, conflict, and division. But influencers are, to a certain extent, reshaping this image, turning Balkans into a digital identity which is fluid, playful, and transnational. And AI embedded into the social media becomes a new actor in this new landscape of transitional justice. So, when we talk about peace building in the digital age, it is important to notice that social media that are typically perceived as battlegrounds of identity politics are also appearing as laboratories of peace building, quite interesting ones, because they are challenging the dominant narratives of political actors and official media, and they contribute to bottom-up peace building. And here I argue in my book that both human and non-human actors, such as algorithms, could produce identity. Even though the algorithms are calibrated for profit-making and they are controlled by companies top-down, they are also, to a certain extent at least, uncontrollable and unpredictable because they are automated systems. And they are sometimes creating unexpected outcomes. They are also capable of undermining even themselves or the companies because simply because they can be appropriated by ordinary users, at least as I said, to a certain extent, and utilized for various causes, including activism. I want to say a few words about the methodology because it's a little bit complex. So it is the digital ethnography is the broad framework of methodological framework. It includes online observation for this period of 2015 to 2023. The field research has been done on YouTube and TikTok. Also the research includes 20 interviews, 20 surveys. So these are semi-structured interviews and supplemented by surveys. Then narrative analysis focus on the samples, two samples, 1,733 YouTube videos and 1,751 TikTok videos. The sampling was based on keywords, hashtags, and geolocation, but the sample was random. Conceptual analysis was very important to simply make a foundation for the concept of algorithmic reconciliation, which is new, and in relation to other concepts such as transnationalism, deterritorialization, digital citizenship, algorithmic identity, etc. Many concepts are included in the analysis. And finally, I want to mention specifically ethnography of AI because it specifically tries to capture through interviews, observation, and the specific type of social media content, which is dubbed algorithmic gossip, which really thematizes algorithms. And so just quickly to show you the map. So this is a kind of a map of these concepts, not of course all of them, but it was important to me to explain how this concept of algorithmic reconciliation can really be actually justified and grounded into previous knowledge. So that's why I consulted a broad range of literature, for many quite surprisingly broad range, but it was important to consider everything from philosophy of technology and some concepts such as simulation. But also transitional justice, theories of identity to consider digital economy, and also to try to reevaluate this concept of reconciliation in this digital era to show how social media perhaps breathing new life into this concept. So this is the map, maybe important to notice also is that I haven't really tried to say that or to claim that social media influencers can really achieve the final goal of reconciliation. So, but what I argue is that social media actually can contribute to it through different types of activities. So through smaller and larger online communities, through different peace building and reconciliation practices that are happening in these everyday interactions. And they can have broader impact on societies simply because they are occurring in these public spaces and can garner a large number of views. And that's why the focus on influencers and also ordinary content creators were very important for this study. This is why they were chosen. I rely heavily on this idea of creative reconciliation, and I explore transnationalism from below through these different activities, and I focus on these alternative practices of reconciliation and showing how social media influencers can actually improve interethnic relations in the region through co-creation, collaboration, and what can perhaps be called viral friendships. The focus on YouTube activism, this is where the whole research started with the first generation of YouTubers from the Balkans, because I think that it can be argued that they created a very tight-knit community of content creators from all over former Yugoslavia, and many of them really believe that they have at least to some extent contributed to reconciliation in the region, and they have done so through collaborations, friendships with their peers. And they often worked, filmed together, traveled together, hosted each other at each other's homes, filmed together at each other's homes. And you can see on the screen some of the types of contents and activities that they that contributed to that perhaps contributed to reconciliation. And these include some of the behind the scenes activities, such as hate speech workshops, that which were some of them were EU through EU funded projects. The shocking question really that I asked myself in the beginning of this research is that could I even talk about reconciliation after wars, genocide, and with the so many years after these atrocities have happened? Could this even be, is this banal? Does this make any sense? And I think that it makes sense because of this, because it presents a certain contribution, which is very interesting and happens on different levels. So, for example, there are talks about this common culture, which is when the influencers are talking about the Balkan culture, they show that it's not simply shared cultural heritage, but rather they are talking about a different understanding of identity, which is no longer purely associated with nationalism or ethnic identity or religious identity, but actually something that is kind of different and shows transnational identity. They promote narratives on the future, but also in addition to this purely commercial influencer content, there are also digital commemorations of and live discussions that tackle problems of the past more directly. But even influencer marketing has this impact on changing these nationalist narratives. And a lot of the work of social media influencers are happening at the background somewhere, where they're deleting hate comments, educating their audiences, etc. And very interestingly, the research that I've conducted really confirms that most of these influencers from the YouTube first generation show that actually most of them believe that they have actually contributed to reconciliation, that all of them said that they did establish interethnic friendships through YouTube, and 75% of them believe that they have personally contributed. A little about this concept of the Balkan identity through this commercial influencer content. What is interesting is that the influencers themselves use the term Balkans in a very peculiar way, often contradicting themselves. For example, in comedic sketches, the Balkans is used as self-stereotyping, confirming Maria Todorova's claim that Balkans used to be typically used as a metaphor for backwardness. However, quite surprisingly, the Balkans also appears as a metaphor for sustainability, health, physical and moral strength, authenticity, something that reminded me of Ljubomir Micić's Barbara of Genius, notoriously against the whole world, but also almost having some kind of a superpower, fighting for real values and real causes, for example, against capitalism, consumer society, and everything that young generations in the Balkans perhaps stand against or stand for. So narrative analysis really shows that being Balkan erases these national, ethnic, and religious identities, And anyone can become Balkanized. And there is a certain fandom created around the Balkans across the whole world through these social media influencers who are not only famous in the Balkan region, but across the world. So it is very peculiar that the Balkans, in this sense, is not simply just a toponym, geographic location, culture, or even a metaphor, but it also becomes the new meanings that social media give, is that it is about algorithmic signifier. It is there to inform the algorithms. It can be in the form of a hashtag, geotag, maybe flag or something. But crucially for many of the content creators and influencers, it is an online community and nothing else. And it can even be totally detached from any kind of cultural or geographic entity. It is something that exists in the online world. And in this sense, the Balkans can be as it is portrayed in these different videos, and as it is signified by these different hashtags, flags, and geotags. It can be even just a single state, two of them, a selection of Yugoslav republics. It can be referred to only as former Yugoslavia, but it can be the whole Balkan Peninsula, including Greece, Bulgaria, etc. It can also include Eastern and Southeast European countries that have never been considered traditionally as Balkan, but it can also be the entire world, anywhere. Balkans can be anywhere, and it can be anything. This is an interesting conclusion, that it is a kind of the empty signifier, full of meanings, but also empty of meanings. Because I wanna also focus on the other forms of this online content creation, which is not simply influencer marketing, but it is content creation. So I want to talk a little bit about TikTok live streams and digital commemorations, just very quickly because I don't have much time. So understanding
Two
of
minutes, even.
traditional justice is that we have that has the traditional transitional justice has kind of failed in the Western Balkans, in the former Yugoslavia, at the level at least of official politics. And therefore, there is a lot of ordinary citizens have decided to take this matter into their own hands. And there are a lot of conversations in live streams, for example, on TikTok, but also on other social media, and digital commemorative practices to commemorate victims, to discuss the war crimes, and to try to establish justice. This is really challenging identity politics bottom up and creating some kind of new narratives. For example, creating these non-ethnic alliances, also present in the case of Serbian student protest movement live streams. The alignments that they are talking about is not following ethnic divisions, and this is very interesting and very new. The quick, so to say, attempt to make some kind of conclusion is that digital activism in this new public sphere, which includes social media, is very participatory. People increasingly participate in political life. They contribute to these discussions, and they are in the position to contribute to reconciliation simply by maintaining friendships online and sharing something on social media. This digital activism is never pure activism, nor pure entertainment or pure commercial activity, but something in between, and it can simply be a fluid activity between these different spheres. And the AI systems appear as both a challenge and opportunity in this sense this cross-platform work, continuous, never-ending work on promotion strategies to increase visibility. They create this precarious work online, but also official narratives are being challenged. There are sometimes coming bottom up and emerging from highly inclusive public sphere. So through everyday peace and spending time together, influencers and content creators are collaborating, simply hanging out, discussing political and other issues. They're practicing coexistence. Some global implications
Ivana, if we can,
can be
if we
drawn
can.
as well. And thank you so much for your attention.
Thank you, Ivana. Okay, we move on now to our last presentation, Natasha.
Yes, hello. Thank you for having me. A really interesting panel, fascinating research and presentations. And to round everything up, I will discuss feminism, women in the Balkans, and see what is the situation with digital feminist activism in the Balkans. So to start the discussion about digital feminist activism in the Balkans, we need to look at, it's really important to look at the context, especially the context of development of feminist movement, feminism. Just to preface, this is my favorite meme that I've put here that really captures the complexity of the region, but also the complexity of gender relations. It's a well-known, very much used meme by feminists and wider. So as the previous discussions already mentioned, it is context of cultural violence, entrenched patriarchal values and norms, remnants of the wars. Real reconciliation has never really happened. And the societies are permanently societies in transition with political, economical, social instability, which very much influences gender relations and positions of women and other marginalized groups in these societies. What is really important for the development of feminism and feminist activism in the region is the so-called NGOization of the feminist movement after the war, after the wars, when there was an influx of foreign donors and projects, which professionalized and kind of made NGOs have a certain structure, which wasn't the case. It was very much a grassroots movement. And this kind of positioned feminism, which is something that is still a widespread perception of feminism as an acceptance of Western values, a foreign import, and therefore in opposition to the mainstream heterosexual, heterosexist nationalist discourse. Very much predominant in the region. This very much feeds into something that is happening right now. We have the renewed traditionalism and strengthening anti-gender movement, which we have to discuss in more detail because it is something that is really, really important and is really much impacting everything that is happening with feminism and feminist movement in the Balkans. So as everywhere globally, religious leaders, institutions, right-wing politicians and parties are those that are leading very much this anti-gender movement. However, a really important actor in the anti-gender movement in the Balkans are civil society organizations. That are backed by foreign networks and national political entities. And these are organizations that started as kind of grassroots movements on social media, especially during the pandemic, and then kind of strengthened into real NGOs, non-governmental civil society organizations. They are very active online on social media. Their strategies are consist of attacks towards women's and LGBTQ plus rights activists through coordinated discursive strategies which portray human rights defenders as corrupt, dangerous, and ideologically extreme, which is very much within the whole context of this perception of Western values as something that corrupts this Balkan national identity. Human rights activists report feeling of insecurity, fear, hopelessness, despair due to the continuous attacks and lack of support from the authorities and the community. Predominantly, the authorities in many of these countries, Balkan countries, are right wing. So they are very much in line with what this anti-gender movement is stating. So I am interested to see how young women enact, how do they assume their feminist identity and enact their feminist activism on social media within this context, and especially young women who are individuals who are not part of NGOs or non-governmental organizations, who are individually going online and discussing feminist issues, women's issues, which wouldn't be possible without these online spaces that have facilitated this position for young women to come online and to assume that feminist identity without needing to be part of any organization. However, being more visible online, especially as a feminist, brings about increased misogyny, attacks, harassment, stalking, violence, a lot of reports. I conducted my PhD research on this. I had a lot of findings about this, which I can't, due to timing, I can't go really into detail in this presentation. But what I will continue in this discussion is looking at the various strategies that these young feminists assume to gain more visibility and to resist these attacks in online spaces, something that they build through affective solidarity and digital sisterhood. The first strategy, very well known, especially with the Me Too movement, hashtag activism. There were several really, really important hashtags that were used in the Balkans. What is important here is to notice that the Me Too movement didn't really happen at the same time, 2017, that happened globally. It came a little bit later in the Balkans, 2021, and was kind of propelled by what was happening during the pandemic, with the discovery of various groups on the social media platform Telegram, where men were sharing personal information, personal photos of young women, many of them minors. So some of the hashtags that were used in the Balkans were I speak up now. That was kind of the first one, 2018. Then you are not alone. I did not report, which kind of elicits women to share their experiences as victims of violence, stating why they didn't report the violence when they were subjected to it. We are with her. You're not alone. These are hashtags to show, to demonstrate solidarity among women. However, the bigger question here, as there is a wider discussion with the Me Too movement right now, is what is the effect? What are the effects of this hashtag activism? Unfortunately, not much. And it's something that is widely discussed among feminists, and along with some of the other issues, as such as putting women who share their experiences in an even more vulnerable position, especially in communities where they're not they were. Smaller communities where everybody knows everybody, as there are in these countries in the Balkans. So, sharing their experiences put them in an even more precarious position in some ways. So, besides bringing more awareness to these issues of violence, of the predominance of violence in the area, it hasn't really achieved that much. Another strategy that young feminist activists use on social media is humor, sarcasm, and satire, using a lot of memes. But what is really, and I chose these examples here to demonstrate how they never escape their Balkan identities, very much predominant in all of the discussion around feminism, around what they're doing, what they're, pointing to, because it is something that is intrinsically part of their experience. There are several profiles that are really followed, famous, well-known in the region. It's all witches, Vala Leposava. Vala Leposava is especially an interesting example. They use this image of this traditional woman from a series that was in the 80s in Serbia, and they adapt it to kind of use it in memes to use for feminist activism now on social media, which is really interesting and fascinating. They also use Simone de Beauvoir and all these famous feminists. Sorry for being so volcanic. This is another meme that is really interesting and very much shared and used by young feminist activists. What is very predominant in all of these discourses and in the activism of young feminists is solidarity as a form of resistance. They are building this feminist solidarity, and something that is very much used as a slogan is kind of taking on Hobbes' famous statement, "Man is wolf to man." And they're adapting it to say woman to woman is not a wolf, but woman to woman stands in solidarity. This is something that they use in different ways. Here we see I selected Kritički, Nina Pavićević, who is one of the most famous, well-known young feminists on especially on Instagram. She organizes workshops, for example, with this slogan. So solidarity is something that is really foundational for digital feminist activism among young women, dismantling those white perceptions that women are always in competition, that women, don't like each other, don't support each other, and emphasizing that women stand together in their fight for their rights. So, what are some of the challenges? I'm aware of time, so this is kind of towards the ending. The challenges are that these young feminists are on social media in times of neoliberalism, and they're still individuals that need to construct that individual identity. So they need to get that visibility by curating their feminine image. Many of them present themselves in very, very feminine way that is appealing for wider audiences. They follow global trends so that they get more they are more they use strategies to get more visibilities on these social media platforms that function on with algorithms. They're packaging often very complex issues, content into visually appealing and content that is easily comprehensible for wider audiences. And they are finding different ways for economic gains because this is what they do, this is their identity, and they need to find ways to profit out of it. So they organize workshops, trainings, talks. They have podcasts. They are on Patreon. So all of these different strategies to kind of profit with this feminist identity. Another.
2 minutes, Alice.
Okay, great. Another challenging aspect right now, as I just discussed, is the ever-growing anti-gender movement, the increase of misogyny, the increase of toxic masculinity on social media, and increased attacks to these women who speak about feminism and women's issues and are visible in that role. This also, the growing anti-gender movement also contributes to larger divisions and exclusions within feminist movement because there are women's organizations that align more with the anti-gender right-wing ideologies and rhetoric than with the feminist ideals. So this also creates divisions and makes the work of these young feminists more difficult. And again, this is again feeding into the perception of these Western values coming into, to destroy the traditional values of these countries in the Balkans. And the last thing that is particularly important as a challenge is there is a lot of burnout. It is not easy being feminist, being very visible as a feminist on social media. During my PhD research, I became friends. I followed my participants. They were very, very active 2 years ago. Now there's hardly any of them posting or discussing anything on social media. So there is this very visible, very obvious burnout and kind of disappointment of this return of traditionalism, of right-wing politics. So, for my conclusion, I don't have any kind of specific conclusion. It's really interesting and important to follow what happens on social media because it is something that forms what is happening in the society and is informed by what is happening in the society. TikTok is now another social media that is becoming more and more prominent. So, continuation of hopefully this strong young generation of feminists, and hopefully they will not lose their feminist fire and will continue to fight against all of this rhetoric that is against women and marginalized groups. So thank you. That was it. I hope I'm on time and I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you so much to all three of you for speaking, informed by your original and recent research on these issues, as I said, from different perspectives. Sanya taking more of a transnational angle, people from the Balkans, even speaking about how people in the Western Balkans engage with these issues, and Natasha taking sort of both perspectives, both more of a transnational, global, and regional. So I would like to invite our audience to ask questions. We already have three questions and conveniently a question for each speaker. So I'll read them out again in the order of speaking, and they're coming from Jasna Dragovic Soso, who is a visiting professor with LISI. Jasna's question, first question for Sanya is, can you tell us a little more about the intersection of generational aspects, gender of respondents, and complex Balkan identities, for example, people who are both Serb and Montenegrin, right? So how do we know? And that's a very important issue of anonymity and projections of identity. So Jasna goes on to ask, how do they construct their identity? Any Yugoslavs from the first generation?
Yeah, thank you so much, Jasna. In terms of generational aspects, as I said in the presentation, the main point of difference between these participants was the time when they arrived. So this was, if you like, the main explanatory variable. And when it comes to generational identity, I didn't maybe go into too many details when I showed the slide with who Serbian Londoners are and these three waves, but I included UK born, which which is like second generation within the first wave. It's because that those respondents that I had, and just mind you, this research was conducted between 2015 and 2018, were the ones who were born before 1990. And what I observed, I had the couple of those who were second generation, but they were all born before 1990. I observed that their communication practices and their identity performances very much resemble or like are similar. There were like common patterns with those who arrived before 1990. So this is why for me, generational identity was kind of a part of this, wave of migration, as I could observe similarities with people who arrive within that wave. But now, if we were to speculate what would happen if I had participants who were born after, I would imagine, based on this knowledge, that they would share characteristics of people who were born within who arrived within that wave. So, if I now did this research and had a participant who were born in 2003, I would assume they would share these characteristics of the third wave of migration. So, generational identity plays very prominently in migration literature. That's true. But this wasn't the key factor in my research. Similarly, with gender, I didn't notice. I had 40 participants. I didn't notice any striking, gender wasn't like a striking variable in explaining these findings, other than women were more keen users of social media than men on average. But again, there wasn't like there in terms of complex Balkan identities, that's very true. So most of my participants had complex identities in a sense. There were both Croats and Serbs, or Slovenian Serbs, Montenegrin Serbs, North Macedonians and Serbs. And which one would play more prominently would depend, this is why we say identities are relational, would depend who they talk with. So I had this participant from North Macedonia who I could notice spoke Macedonian with a person from her hometown, whereas in a broader a network of people from the Balkans, it's her Serb identity would be more prominent and so on. And a Balkan identity played very prominently. Actually, many of my participants had these WhatsApp groups called like Balkan Crew, or they would share Balkan memes, similar to the ones that Ivana showed in her slides. So all these identities, were prominent in my findings, but it depended on who they were talking with in relation to who they were performing these identities, which is again going back to this idea of identity as relational. Yugoslav was as well common, perhaps not as common as Balkan, but sometimes it's very interesting. These identities weren't just purely sentimental or a matter of affect. They were sometimes very strategic, So if someone works in marketing and they want to attract more people, they would put like Yugoslav or Balkan rather than Serb, because that would, attract like wider audience and so on. So it's not always, when you think of these identities, that are not always very much based on some kind of emotions and so on. Sometimes they're very pragmatic and strategic as well. Sorry if my answer was too long, but yeah, I hope I have answered your question.
Yes, now you can follow up if needed. So next question was for Ivana. Does humor play an important role in online reconciliation? Is it a vehicle for a reconciliation, and in what ways?
Thank you so much, Jasna, for the question. I would say that humor is really important. It's actually an interesting issue. It is kind of a glue for the community. It is something that makes these posts very attractive. And it is something without which I don't think I can imagine that the communities can even connect. But I think that the most important conversations are actually happening when they are serious. And when we have so contribution to reconciliation would perhaps be those moments when, for example, in the live stream, people would be talking about accepting each other's victims, talking about war crimes, accepting that their nation has committed a crime, or, for example, telling to each other that they recognize war crimes, for example, accepting that genocide has happened in Srebrenica, or that Kosovo is an independent state, and those polarizing issues, really. And I would say that also humor is interesting because humor is interestingly important because it is happening in those live streams as well. It is happening. It is a very important element in the influencers' videos, and humor is crucially important for these videos, which are ridiculing the Balkans and self-stereotyping, but also presenting it as something unique and something that is like an appealing global, perhaps, identity, Balkan identity. So yes, I would say that it's important. Thank you so much for the question. And if there's anything else I can clarify, let me know.
Okay, so I would like to just invite our participants to use the Q&A function to ask questions. And we also have a question also from Jasna for Natasha. So this is a very interesting, taps into the very interesting debate in the peace-building literature, the relationship between digital and analog processes. So Jasna is asking, do the online feminist activists also participate in embodied on-site activism, or do they focus on their online presence?
Yes, thank you for this question. Really important. I didn't really go went into it during my presentation due to the timing. I actually at the beginning I included a photo of a protest in the presentation, but then I deleted it. I took it out. And I wanted to talk about it when I was discussing hashtag activism and how actually it was really ineffective, where we see real change, a real possibility to impact, to affect policies, is with on-site protests on the street. And there have been many, many protests. A couple of years ago, there were massive protests organized in Serbia when there was interview with a rapist that was published in the media, and women went in the street and were protesting really visibly. And these were also the same young women who are on social media. So very much they are both online and offline, if we can make such a distinction anymore, right? But where we see real change and real wider discussion in the society is when actually there are things happening on the streets.
Thank you very much, Natasha. You have thank you from Jasna as well. I know all your work, but always when I listen to present, I am inspired to ask further questions. So I too have a question for each of you, and I will again also start with Sanya. So you put emphasis on interpersonal, and also when responding to Jasna's questions, you talked about the audience. So I have kind of two sub questions there. So when you presented who the Serbs, so in your presentation, you focused mostly on the Serbs, not on people with complex identities, as far as I understood. So if the communication is interpersonal, have you also tracked conversations between the Serbs? Because I would assume, from what we know about the studies of contentious identity, lots of contention doesn't necessarily happen with those who other us, who themselves are others, but also the processes of othering within a community. And to what extent this was an issue in your data that you could track. And the second was that this question about, you said depends who the speaker is or who the audience is. But in your research, we don't necessarily see that audience, or we don't see how they concretely engage with whoever the speakers are. I get the idea, get a sense that you're talking about how these people themselves imagine their audiences and what that audience is, right? So this is almost, I would call it presumed or assumed stigmatization, right? So I would just like to ask you, kind of, how did you track how exactly, why, by who exactly do they feel stigmatized, and what is the evidence for that? That they actually were stigmatized in all cases, right? If you're generalizing. For Ivana, my question would be about sort of connecting your presentation on different understandings of reconciliation. And just literally before you brought in that last slide and the discussion about where people on TikTok get together to ask difficult questions. And begin to talk about the legacies of war. I wanted to ask you, what do you feel and think in terms of how reconciliation can occur, right? If it's through, I don't know, sharing chips, crisps, and videos, and sort of doing marketing together or just hanging out together. It is important, but one critique would be that this is actually trivializing reconciliation, that if you want to reconcile, you need to address these difficult questions or the questions of legacies. Again, there is literature that says that you necessarily don't have to. So kind of the literature and pulls in two different directions there. So I would just be interested in, because you have data on both processes happening at the same time. And with Natasha, again, you literally in your last slide begin to discuss issues of division in the feminist movement. And we do know that some parts of the feminist movement in former Yugoslavia was very important because it maintained the links despite of the conflict, but other parts of the feminist movement basically fell apart along these nationalist lines. So my question would be to you, are these conflicts between feminists also happening online? So is there a sort of a different story to the story of feminist sisters, solidarity and sort of sisterhood playing out at the same time? And then what is the effect of that? So over to you. Maybe Sonia, because you had some time to think and you were the first.
Happy to answer. Thank you so much, Denisa. It gives me an opportunity to maybe clarify some things that weren't perhaps clear from my presentation or things I haven't had a chance to touch upon. So firstly, in terms of identity, I did study people with more complex identities. As I said, what they all shared in common was an orientation to a Serbian identity. So they would identify to an extent as Serbs, but that not in exclusive terms. That doesn't mean that they don't share other identities, or they don't identify in other ways. And what they think being Serbian means is also very different among them. And I didn't unpack fully this slide on these three waves that I have identified. But if we now think of the second wave, there is this category of self-proclaimed atypical Serbs, or people who arrived in late 90s or early 2000. These were people who didn't want first to take part in my research. They were like, no, I'm not a typical Serb, I'm not the best person to be studied on the issue of national identity should go and study the church community, you know. And so there was an assumption even among, you know, Serbs who like is the proper respondent for my study. So, you know, this shows you that nearly all of my participants had very complex identities and so on. So this is one thing. And in terms of who they communicate with, actually, most of this communication was taking place with other Serbs, primarily their family and relatives. And this is where I was putting a lot of emphasis on these strong ties or important, significant others. Also, friends in Serbia or other Serbs in London. This is why I make this distinction between publicly oriented platforms, which are for like wide and diverse audiences, and as you say, sometimes imagined audiences, because people don't always know who will see this if they have over 100 or 200 or 500 of friends or followers. But there was also communication happening on privately oriented platforms that are often reserved with these important people, such as one's family and relatives. And as a matter of fact, I showed in this last quote of the participant who was explaining how what this development and improvements and innovations in digital media and technology meant for her interpersonal relationship, particularly with her family, and consequently what it meant with her for her identity. She was explaining how once she was able to have all these platforms on her phone and, you know, supported with mobile data, that she has this immediate contact with her parents. She's being surrounded and exposed to this national identity, such as through language, through references to food, to some places in Belgrade and so on, which are reproducing this sense of belonging to this nation, not through geography, but through these traditions and culture. And this is why I say it depends on the authority of the speaker, because I haven't had a chance to show you everything, but this participant has a very strong bond with her family. And what we really find is that digital media don't solve things. So if the relationship is not strong, it's not like digital media will improve it. But if the relationship is strong and she has strong relation with her parents, what happens is the digital media enables her really to be surrounded with this identity. And this is why she's willing really to engage in Serbian culture, tradition, and so on, because of her good relation with her family, which is why I say it depends on the authority of the speaker. Unless she didn't have this good relation with her family, she would understand this intensified communication through digital media as a burden, not as an opportunity to be involved in these cultural practices and so on. There, in chapter 7, particularly in my book, I also talk about the role of Facebook. So now going beyond this interpersonal, you know, with family and close friends, and thinking about Facebook that, you know, opens us to wider audiences, so on. What I find is that Facebook helped recreate diaspora community in London. You know, Serbs live everywhere in London. There isn't one particular geographic area where they're mostly densely populated. Perhaps it's still Ealing, but you know, with most recent migrations, they're spread. So what Facebook offered was this kind of recreated this physical surveillance that was lost. It recreated it online. However, there were still lines of these waves. This was still divided across the lines of waves of migration. So people still, again, within the second wave, would be better connected with ones within this way, and so on and so forth. There would be some overlapping, but so you will end up still with Serbs within first wave who speak more to other Serbs within first wave, which again leads to this reproduction of what Serbian identity is about, you know, that is shared, particularly within this wave. So there were these differences. So yeah, I'll stop here. Yeah, I hope I've clarified these, but I'm happy to take more questions.
Thank you, Sonia. Ivana?
Thank you so much, Denisa, for this super important question, which really touches the core of the problem. This is a question that I was asking myself the whole time during this whole process of research and then writing the book, and then also afterwards I have been facing this problem of, whether if we're talking about social media, are we talking about trivialization of reconciliation, or what is it exactly? So this is why for me it was important to look into this as if it we need. So my approach to it, right, how I see it, is that we need to contextualize this. So it is not possible to talk about one method for reconciliation, but it's rather happening on different levels, I think. It is happening in different contexts, reconciliation for especially for example, some of us who actually lived in Bosnia and were facing this in person. So this is also something that it's that was important in helping me define how I feel about reconciliation. How do I want to define it among these many, many definitions? And should I use this concept at all? This is also a question somebody will ask, well, are you sure that you should even use the concept of reconciliation? Shouldn't you rather use some other concept? But for me, it seems that first of all, it for different people, different amount of things would be enough to reconcile. So for some, it would be enough to accept apology, and for some, they would even require some kind of punishment of the nation which caused the harm to them. So it would be very difficult. But if here we are talking about the contribution to reconciliation, to the overall, let's say, reconciliation, also to reconcile on certain levels. So I would see it as multi-level, complex phenomenon, which also has different contextualization. So in some contexts, something would be called full reconciliation, something would be half, and some people can never fully reconcile. So we really should think of it as in this kind of granular way, I think. And but what is interesting that for these conversations on social media, that I see that reconciliation should be happening. What I wanted to say is that these conversations on TikTok, in different social media platforms, they are really multiplying, and they are raising the level, the awareness that we need to reopen this problem. So this is what I think that my research is showing, that there is a need to reopen this and to finally really face the past, because it seems that it hasn't happened before. And interestingly, again, I just want to mention this example of conversations about Srebrenica that reappear in the context of Serbian protests and live streams of and content shared on social media about Serbian protests. So in this sense, this issue of Srebrenica is reopening, and this is an interesting way how bottom up we can raise this issue and reopen transitional justice dialogue and ask ourselves what reconciliation means today.
Thank you, Ivana. And Natasha?
Yes, thank you for the important question, especially at the moment. What is happening with the division in the feminist movement in the Balkans is nothing that is very different from what is happening globally with the anti-gender movements everywhere, especially in the US, what we're seeing right now. What is really interesting to me is, and I had one of these collectives of young feminists who formed as a collective on social media, who are called Women's Solidarity. They identify as radical feminists. They identify with second wave feminism and are very much exclusionary to trans gender people, are against sex work and all of these, wider feminist issues. as a young woman in their 20s, to me it was really interesting to discuss with them and see why do they assume that position going back to that time of feminism. But it is very much within what is happening at the moment with the whole backlash, with the whole revival, if we can say so, of these ideas, ideologies, with the anti-gender movement. We have a lot of feminists who are supportive of saying that feminism has gone too far, as you know, and supporting what Trump is doing and the policies that are being made in Western context. So we had a couple of months ago in North Macedonia, there was a famous feminist activist who actually published an article saying that she's supporting Trump and everything that he's doing, that it's time to go back to fighting for women's rights, you know, all of those things. So it is something that is happening, and it's really important to see how do these divisions play, especially among younger women who we expect to be more progressive. We cannot expect for these feminists who have been in feminism since the 90s, since the wars, to be progressive, even though some of them are. But from young women, I was expecting to see more of these kind of more progressive ideas, but it is not always so. So it is something that I am following, and I'm really interesting to see further developments and hopefully some more progressive activism being more visible.
Thank you,
Hope
Natasha.
that answers your question.
Thank you. Yes, watch this space to see how it all evolves. Well, our time is up, so I would like to thank all of you as speakers. I'd like to thank our audience as well, Jasna, as well for questions. Please watch this space for future discussions that we'll be organizing, and also the recording of this event will be available in case you want to rewind and look up. So thank you again, and goodbye.
Thank you very much, Lisa. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you. Thank
Bye
you
bye.
so much. Thank you, everyone.